The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence, and by PRI's The World.
I've lived in the United States for close to 30 years, and I have to say, entire months, sometimes years go by, when I'm simply not aware of the presence in this country of Native Americans. Okay, I don't live in Alaska, though I did once and things were different there. But in most parts of the U.S., how often do you actually hear about the lives of Native Americans? Unless there's a tribe nearby that wants to build a casino or something like that, it's just not on the radar, not part of the zeitgeist. But this year is different, thanks to the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. You can't but have noticed this, right? It's a big international story, a protest that on the face of it is about contamination of water supply. But really, it's about so much more. Land, belief, authority, history. And the tribe whose land and water is right next to this proposed pipeline is the Standing Rock Sioux, part of the Lakota Sioux. It just had to be them, the old enemies of the U.S., They fought at Little Bighorn. They were driven from their sacred Black Hills land. They were massacred at Wounded Knee. The Lakota Sioux know more than most about making a stand at a historic moment. The Dakota Access Pipeline, it wasn't going to pass them by. At the protest camp on the plains of North Dakota, people from all over the world are there. You've probably seen the videos. There are lots of local people there too. Kids, reservation kids, learning about who they are. There's been a makeshift school there, described here in this local TV report.
This tent is the main classroom where kids learn storytelling, drum making, cooking, leadership, and traditional Lakota.
We're learning how to speak our language.
Lakota language.
Our Lakota language, yeah.
The Lakota language, spoken across several reservations in North and South Dakota. Or not spoken. Not that much, anyway. Maybe a few thousand speakers. The estimates, they vary a bit. But if the Lakota language is dying, it's not going without a fight. That's what we're going to talk about today, with a bunch of very determined people. People who want to ensure that Lakota is written down in a way that reflects how it's spoken, or how it was spoken. There are differences of opinion there. Everyone, of course, wants the language to be documented accurately. Accurately, though, it means different things to different people. And accuracy is not the first thing that you associate with the Sioux tribe. I mean, think about all of those movies. The Sioux were very much the favorite Native Americans of Hollywood. Their leaders were immortalized in one form or another. Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Spotted Elk, and of course, Crazy Horse.
This is our country, the sacred land of our fathers. I will fight for it, and I will die for it.
And who better to play Crazy Horse back in 1955 than Victor Mature, whose proud ancestry was Italian and Swiss. This movie is like so many about the Sioux. It depicts them as warriors with a purity of spirit.
It is the story of a man, starting when, as a boy, he beheld a vision of greatness.
Purer often than the white man, but also with less money, fewer guns, and a bit uneducated, a tad slow, except on horseback. And just in case you think that I, sophisticated European that I am, in case you think that my exposure to Native American culture was any more nuanced in my upbringing than your average American's, well, it wasn't. I'm just going to put this out there. When I was a teenager, I was a big fan of Adam Ant. And Adam Ant was a big fan of the noble American savage. I don't know if you can make all of that out, but what he's chanting is Blackfoot, Pawnee, Cheyenne, Crow, Apache, Arapaho. Adamant knew his North American tribes. Okay, so Victor Mature and Adamant, let's call them Exhibits A and B. For Exhibit C, I'll hold off a bit on that. Maybe you can guess, a famous movie in which quite a bit of Lakota is spoken. I heard quite a lot of Lakota myself recently. I went to 3 Sioux reservations spread across North and South Dakota. I knew that to tell a story about the Lakota language, where it is now, where it may be in the future, I knew that to tell it properly, I had to spend most of the time hearing about the Lakota language in the past. I mean, the past is everything, right?
My name is Marie Kildensite.
Born in 1952.
And in my language, the last name is Tr'inkde.
I meet Marie at a Lakota cultural museum she runs on the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota. The museum is part of a complex owned by the St. Francis Catholic Mission. The church buildings are the biggest, the sturdiest, the most decorous in town. You see that time and again in these small reservation communities.
I was born out in the country. Spoke my language, went to school, learned the English, and I was baptized Catholic.
Marie didn't have what we may think of as the typical Native American school experience. She wasn't shipped off to boarding school, stripped of her clothes and language and everything else she knew. That didn't happen.
I never heard any of the teachers, tell us, don't speak Lakota, speak English only. I never heard that. So eventually, when the class is over, all the kids go outside and they're back to their language.
Marie always loved that moment. She says it was when she could put her tongue back in place. At church, they had the same semi-relaxed attitude to language. The service was conducted in English and some Latin.
But the songs were sung in Lakota and English. To me, spiritually, it's a deeper connection when you pray in your language to, the Creator.
The Jesuit missionaries who came here, they knew this. They knew that belief was more powerfully held in your heart language. That's what some Bible translators still today call it, your heart language, your native tongue. The missionary whose work left the greatest impression on Marie was a man called Eugene Beekel. That's the way they pronounce it here. His last name is spelt B-U-Umlaut-C-H-E-L. Father Beekel was born in Germany in 1874.
He came in the 1900s with the rest of the Jesuits. They started St. Francis Mission, and they worked with, Spotted Tail, Chief Spotted Tail. They call them black robes because how the priests are, dressed.
Father Beekel learned Lakota. He often stayed in the homes of his parishioners. He helped write a Lakota language hymnal, also a grammar for the language, full of examples of usage that he picked up from Lakota speakers. In fact, in his book, he lists his sources.
Arrowside, Black Elk, Bull Ring. Here's Kildensite, Charles. That's my grandfather.
And then Marie shows me the crowning achievement.
And here we have a Lakota English dictionary.
Father Beekel died before completing the dictionary, but it left its mark. And this is where we're going to leave Marie Kildensite for the time being. And go to, I know this sounds incongruous, but we're going to go to Eastern Europe, to the country that was then called Czechoslovakia.
When I was young, I lived in a communist country.
This is a man called Jan Ulrich.
And we were not free, we were oppressed. We were oppressed by colonizing power, and we sympathized with other people who had a history of being colonized.
There was sympathy for the oppressed, yes, but not many hard facts.
This was the time before internet, and this was the time before the wall fell down, so we were pretty isolated at that time.
Lesí, 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 les Jan loved languages, and he loved to figure out how they worked. He learned Russian, because he had to, and then later English. And then?
In 1986, I went to a museum in Prague, our capital, and I found the 1852 Riggs Dakota Dictionary. And that was my first contact with the language.
Dakota is closely related to Lakota. And that dictionary that Jan found, the Riggs one, it was edited by Christian missionaries. It was a forerunner to Father Beagle's Lakota Dictionary. Jan read it, and he wanted to know more. But he couldn't just hop on a train or in a car to Western Europe, to a library or somewhere. That was nigh on impossible.
I was lucky. I had a friend who emigrated out of the country with his parents, and he was able to send me some books from the U.S. about Lakota language and Lakota culture.
And so began Jan's Lakota education. 3 years after he found the dictionary, the wall came down, and things became a lot easier, but also more complicated. The more Jan studied the old texts, the documents that first committed the Lakota language to paper, the more confused he got.
When I was able to get hold of materials from the missionaries, the dictionaries and some of the other things from the missionaries, it became obvious that those materials did not match what other authors wrote about the language, primarily a native speaking linguist. And to me, that became a big puzzle.
So what were the missionaries saying that was so different from the native speaker?
Do you want the long story or the short story?
I asked for the long story, though Jan's throat was playing up, so it wasn't the longest long one. In any case, I'll give you the short version. Remember that first dictionary that Jan found in the library in Prague, the Dakota one? Well, Dakota was the dialect that all those early missionaries worked on. It was spoken in Minnesota, and so missionaries from the eastern United States came across Dakota speakers first. The missionaries' job, as they saw it, was to learn the language, come up with a writing system for it, if it hadn't previously been written down, translate the Bible into Dakota, and then evangelize the Native Americans. That's actually still what Bible translators do today. They take these languages that don't have a writing system and they give them the writing system, though they do it now with the help of big data and algorithms. So anyway, missionaries in Minnesota started collecting Dakota words and writing them down.
They translated the Dakota words with a kind of a European and Christian bias, what they thought the words meant. Very often it was not correct. It was a bias, a strong bias. And sometimes they also misunderstood words.
Misunderstood them and then spelled them inconsistently.
The problem was that they did not hear some of the sound distinctions, phonemic distinctions in the Dakota language, because they were foreign to their language and because they were not trained as linguists. So when they established the orthography, the spelling system for Dakota, they did their best, but they failed.
They just didn't have the ear for it. And not only that, they didn't know that they didn't have the ear for it. You know what that's like, right? The way a Japanese speaker, for example, can't distinguish between L and R. Well, it was the same for these missionaries. They couldn't distinguish between certain sounds. And so these different sounds ended up looking exactly the same on the page. And then things got even worse. And I'm afraid to say it's all to do with the arrival in Lakota country of our old Jesuit friend, Father Beagle.
When Father Beagle came to the Lakota people in 1902, he wanted to learn the Lakota dialect, and the only material that he could find was the Dakota dictionary from the early 19th century.
So he studied this dictionary with its flawed alphabet and its Christian biases, and he studied it in order to learn a related dialect, kind of like if you ended up studying a Swedish text in order to learn Danish. No, actually, if you study a poorly written Swedish text in order to learn Danish. And so Beagle imported the inaccuracies of the original dictionary, and then he added some more because he assumed that Dakota and Lakota were essentially the same. This part of the story It feels like some sort of cell mutation. The more mutant cells there are, the more they replicate, and the DNA sequence is further and further compromised.
So basically what happened is that Bekele borrowed over 18,000 words from the Dakota Dictionary. He borrowed all the biases, and he introduced a lot of errors.
Errors of his own. And these errors calcified and became part of the language for people like Marie Kills in Sight. Remember, this is the dictionary and spelling system so beloved by Marie. Why wouldn't she feel more attached to it? What does she care if a linguist from some faraway country says it's not accurate? It's the Lakota she knows, the one she grew up with.
To me, when I looked at that book, I would pronounce it and I know what it means. Every time I look at this book, I am so happy somebody did something back then.
But she's not so happy, though she's far too polite to say so, about a new written version of Lakota, one that Jan Ulrich has been helping with. The script is different, with an enlarged alphabet, 38 letters. It's more regulated. The sounds and the letters, they match. To Marie's eyes, though, it's a spelling system with training wheels on for non-native speakers.
The people who want to learn, they're making it easier and they're adding extra letters in there for them to say.
No mystery about it. No history. Just
phonics.
That's as disparaging as Marie gets. But this new alphabet, it's been largely adopted. Jan Ulrich says, yes, it is easier to read, but it's not some outside alphabet imposed on the language. No, he says, it reflects the authentic sounds of Lakota, and it draws on the work of others who've made recordings of the language. Linguists, not missionaries. One of those linguists was called Ella Deloria.
Deloria was a native-speaking linguist and is one of my heroes.
I could do a whole podcast just on this woman. She had the most unbelievable life. She was raised on Standing Rock Reservation, went to college at Oberlin and Columbia. She graduated in 1915. She then became a novelist, a dance teacher, and a translator of Lakota stories. And just like Father Bekele, she died before completing her Lakota dictionary.
She could go to the community as a native person and ask elders to tell her stories. So she collected an enormous number of these narratives on mythology, legends, autobiographies, and so on. And it was documented from speakers who were monolingual. So it is a documentation of the language as it existed before major contact with English.
Deloria's fieldwork came just in time. It was pretty much the last generation of monolingual Lakota speakers. The native speakers since then, we're talking about the past 5 or 6 decades, they speak English too. They're bilingual. And Jan says that's influenced their Lakota. Jan works these days with a group of elders. They published a grammar that tries to strike a balance between the old pre-English ways of saying things and newer forms of expression. They figure out whether changes in the grammatical structures are borrowed from English or are just part of natural language evolution. They also meet to discuss proposed new words.
We'd put up some suggestions, we'd discuss it some more, and then we'd take a vote, see how many people, most of the people that are in the group are native speakers.
Ben Blackbear is on the New Words Committee.
You could create an artificial language. We don't want to do that, you know? We heard that, for example, that movie they call Avatar. Yeah.
Navi. Somebody made up the language.
Yeah, exactly. They made up that language, an artificial language. You know, we don't want to do that.
So whoever suggests a word or phrase, they have to back it up with evidence that it's rooted in the Lakota language.
For example, the word for apple is taspan. When you take the skin off the pulp or the inside of the apple, under the skin feels like snow, wet snow. Span sort of describes wet snow. And tra is just anything that's the pulp that's inside something. Like we call meat. The word meat is talo.
Stuff that's inside an animal.
Yeah, stuff that's inside an animal. So talo means meat. Well, they took the same idea, ta, and then they described it as spun, which is like wet snow, you know. So they put those two concepts together for the word apple, you know, traspin.
That word has been in the language for a good 100 years. There are many much newer ones. Here's a few that are going through the approval process right now. And sorry, I'm not even going to attempt to say them in Lakota. Here's one, the word for mattress, which literally translates as they sleep on it. Velcro, they make it stick. Socialism, that's interesting, it's two words in Lakota, the word for property and this phrase, they let them share in. Another new one, the word pecan, as in, you know, the nut, that literally translates as one that is hard to crack open. I'm not sure if that's used metaphorically too, but there sounds like there's possibilities there. And here's my favorite one. Try guessing this. It's a type of bird that doesn't live anywhere close to Lakota country. The literal translation of the proposed Lakota word is clumsy bird. What do you think? It's a puffin. If you've ever seen a puffin fly, the clumsy thing makes total sense. So for these and many other new Lakota words, they'll eventually find their way into textbooks for learners of the languages, kids' textbooks, and ones for adults, too. Elena Eagleshield teaches both groups. Here she is leading an adult class at Standing Rock Sitting Bull College. Most of the students are tribal members, but there are some others, too.
You say left, that means it's around the area of yourself. So left. This, it's around you. When you say head, it's around the listener. So he doesn't have to be holding it, but it'll be around him.
Elena herself is a second language learner.
I've been learning for about 4 years now, but my dad's a fluent speaker, so I grew up around it. He just never taught me.
He didn't want to force it on her, she says. It was so problematic being Lakota, being associated with the poverty on the reservation, with all the crime, with the burden of being one of history's victims. That all played into her father's decision. There was no way, Elena says, that he was going to make her learn the language. But now that she is learning it...
He's happy. He always told me he wanted it to be my choice. And when I was ready, he was going to help me. And there have been times when I was little where I'm like, okay, Dad, I think I'm ready. You know, okay, maybe not. Too hard. And once I got pregnant with my own daughter, I decided that I wasn't going to give my kids that option, and that I tried to decide what I could do to give them the best chance at life that I could give them. And for me, that was giving them a sense of who they truly are.
The alternative, she says, is pretty bleak.
I don't know if you've ever been around the res, but a lot of people think they're in gangs. You know, they don't know what a gang really is. They've never, maybe from TV, I don't know. There's a lot of gangs. There's a lot of jumpings, you know, where people fight. There's a lot of bickering. And to me, I feel like that is them not having a sense of identity or who they are.
When she says that, I get it. I see what drives Elena. And she's a pretty driven person. I understand why she's so determined to expose her daughter to the language, both at home and at school. It's a relatively new Lakota immersion school.
We drive 2 hours a day, and sometimes it gets tough for her. And she's like, why do I have to go to school there? You know, why this? Why that? And sometimes I get discouraged by it because it's expensive, but definitely good sacrifices in the long run. Reassuring myself, because it does get tough, and there are times I want to quit.
But she doesn't. In fact, a few weeks ago, Elena started a new project. She became the teacher at that makeshift Lakota school at the Pipeline protest site. She and several others I met, they're as determined to reintroduce Lakota as so many of the previous generation were to let it go. Generations before that, everything was in Lakota, of course.
I was always told stories of my ancestors. So my dad is a direct descendant of Mary Crawler. And Mary Crawler was a woman in the Battle of Little Bighorn who went mid into the battle and saved her brother. And so she was really honored for that. And so she carried a name that I carry is Hochoka Kutepiwi, which means shoots at her in the center or shoots at her in the midst. And because she was never hit, like, that was a powerful name for her. That was a name that was passed on to me. And so having that pride and, you know, who I am, and just always being able to turn to my culture and turn to my language was really what helped me.
I don't really know where this leaves Lakota. It's not in good shape as a spoken language. Everyone agrees on that. But it's in better written shape. It's better looked after. And it's hard not to root for it when you see a bunch of people converge on Standing Rock from various parts of the U.S. and beyond for 3 weeks of intensive classes.
Wow, new spa. Do wecha o new spa. Everybody, do wecha.
It's a start. I suppose you could almost call it a restart. I want to thank a few people for helping put this podcast episode together. Elliot Bannister and Yulia Manyakina were both tremendously helpful. I'm indebted to them both. Also, thanks to Sunshine Archambault Carlo and Peter Hill for giving me so much of their time. Oh yeah, that movie that has a bunch of Lakota spoken in it. Exhibit C, right? Dances with Wolves. Kind of a mixed bag, Dances with Wolves. It did engage a tribal linguist to coach the actors. It did have a bunch of Native American actors playing Native American characters, and the plot certainly moved beyond the usual Native American cliches. But the main role, played by Kevin Costner, was a white guy who turned into a bit of a savior. But I think it's fair to say that, on the whole, it was warmly received by most Lakota people. I snapped some pictures of everyone you heard from today. They're at pri.org/language. You can get there also via Facebook. There's a World in Words page. We're on Twitter, at LingoPod. Please leave us a review at iTunes or wherever you listen. One sentence will do it. Thanks very much. We'll be back soon.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence, and by PRI's The World.